Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm Professor Barlo Dermogradichian. My guest today is Ara Sarafian, and we're discussing his work in the Gomidas Institute, some of the initiatives that they've been working on, publishing in books, Genocide Institute, genocide studies, and other things. I want to go back to what you were talking about I found it very intriguing, about the commemoration of April 24th in Turkey. We can take Istanbul, but let's take Diyarbakir, because you've been involved in Diyarbakir. How has it become possible for a public Armenian genocide commemoration to take place in Diyarbakir, which by all accounts was probably one of the worst provinces for Armenians in the Armenian genocide? How does that take place? Who did you have to meet? And can you tell us a little bit about how that first came about?
Yes.
The first time?
I think it was 2013 when the mayor of Diyarbakir made a public plea saying Armenians should come to their city, Diyarbakir. And in the diaspora, there was a lot of negative comments on this, dismissive, you know, the Kurd says this is a trick, whatever. And I was in London. I said, all right, let's test it. I mean, we shouldn't, it's an opportunity, right? So working through the Human Rights Association in Turkey, I contacted the mayor's office in Diyarbakir. And I said to them, you know, I'd like to come to Diyarbakir this April 24th and read a statement on the bridge where so many armies left on pontoons and murdered, right? And the mayor of Diyarbakir's office responded saying, yes, we are welcome. They didn't even ask what I had to say on the bridge, partly, I guess, because they knew who I was. But they welcomed me. They said, can you do that on the 23rd? Because for some reason, the mayor would not be there on the 24th. And that was the first test they passed. Within a matter of days, the Bar Association heard about this in Diyarbakir. They contacted me, Tahir Elçi, who was murdered in 2015. He said, Ara, I heard you coming here. Fantastic. Let's have a conference. So suddenly it becomes a major. So I tested them and they passed. I tested them and they gave the opportunity. We had an amazing conference about the Armenian genocide. I was free to say what I had to say on the bridge. In fact, when I was there, I also went to Batman and I tested some Armenian sources. Thomas Dermogradichian's story about the massacre of 600 Armenians in 1915. So I went to the massacre scene. And as far as I was concerned, this story was productive. So we are not naive. That's the point I'm saying. If you are knowledgeable and you got the courage and you test, you push the limits, you can then decide whether you want to go that direction or you don't want to go that direction. Now, this is how Diyarbakir started. I made local contacts and local friends. There's a local Armenian community. And we continue doing a commemoration in Diyarbakir where the local people supported us, the local mayor's office, the Human Rights Association, the Bar Association. And you realize that nobody denied the Armenian genocide in Diyarbakir. And in 2015, when the whole world was looking on it to Istanbul, because, you know, it's convenient, right, Istanbul, Diyarbakir was the main commemoration was where, as you said, which was a major massacre site where the descendants of people who carried out the massacre were recognizing the Armenian genocide. The head of the HDP came to Diyarbakir, not Istanbul, Demirtas, who's also in jail now. And when I was on the podium there, I looked around me and I said, you know, the Kurdish representatives around me represent millions of people, millions of Kurds. And here they are publicly stating their role as Kurds in the Armenian genocide and their wish for atonement, that they need to solve this question. So there's no trickery involved here. Once you acknowledge with no questions, with no qualification, they're not saying some Kurds did this or it happened in this place or that place. No, collectively they accept what happened. And that's contrition. When there's contrition, there's the possibility of peace building. And it's been positive ever since. I still believe that the genocide recognition will start in Turkey piecemeal. Southeastern Turkey, as a rule, it's accepted, the Kurdish areas. And it's a question of building on that. The question is there an appetite in the diaspora to engage and to make progress? Or do we want to just keep in a big placard and saying, we want our lands back, we want this, we want that, which is impractical and in some ways, I think, unethical. And I often give this example. 95% of Armenian properties in Eastern Turkey do not exist anymore. They were mud huts and whatever. They haven't survived the age. The people living there today are often refugees themselves. Diyarbakir went from being a town of 40,000 people to over a million, mainly because the Turkish government destroyed so many Kurdish villages in 1990. When you walk in Diyarbakir, you see the real refugee population. So for us to say we want property back, material back, it's almost obscene for us. Surely we want a moral resolution. And I always say there is, personally, right? I cannot speak for other Armenians, but personally, I can say you can never compensate for what you did to Armenians. You owe us forever. In some ways, like slavery in the United States, you can never compensate for the legacy of slavery or for the Native Americans for that matter. We owe them forever. So then the question is, how do we regulate ourselves? In Diyarbakir, we have the beginnings. In fact, as you know, in Diyarbakir, the St. Giragos Church has been renovated. They didn't just renovate the church. They compensated the church for its loss of properties, not by kicking Kurdish refugees out of a few remaining houses or whatever in the Armenian quarter, but they compensated them by giving them land outside of the city. It's a creative way of engaging the very principle of compensation, right? They're not even against that. There's acknowledgement, there is contrition, and they're looking for practical ways of engaging the legacy of the Armenian genocide. And this is a very good beginning, right? Morally,
No, the fact is that though the people that you work with were the local leaders, right, of Diyarbakir, that is at the mayoral level, maybe sub-mayors, district leaders, mostly Kurdish, right?
Yes, but they're elected local mayor. First, they're elected officials. That's very important. Secondly, they're the intellectual caste there. The Bar Association is probably the most sophisticated element of Kurdish society today. Right now in Diyarbakir, I believe they've got over 2,000 members. Unqualified. By the way, they're being sued right now by the Turkish government because last year they made statements on the Armenian genocide, even in our absence, right? They made statements on the Armenian genocide. They're being sued. But with all the troubles that they've got with persecution, they've still got the Armenian issue on their laps. I feel sorry for them. So we have, in many ways, we have Kurdish civil society. And also, they've made statements that you cannot undo. You had people who talk tribal leaders or descendants of tribal leaders who are recognizing their role in the Armenian genocide. They're publishing books about how Kurds participated in the Armenian genocide. There is no turning back. I think it's a moral position that we should value because it is a basis of lasting peace. Unless your agenda is to more strife, you know, war, strife, changing boundaries. Unless you believe that some sort of military solution, which I morally I'm against, this is the most prudent way of going forward. There's absolute rejection, acknowledgement on the Kurdish side, and there's an openness to any debate, including compensation. You can talk about compensation and restitution if you want. They will not be offended, and then they can discuss with you the practicalities and whether it's right. And you know, I would always say I'd like to see the American Armenians also pay restitution to the Native Americans because you're living on their land. I mean, do we really want to get this into this type of debate? Maybe we can. But there are more practical ways of immediate issues that we can resolve. And frankly, we can nurture an Armenian presence in Diyarbakir because there is a fledgling presence. There are Armenians who are coming out, Islamized Armenians, some who convert to Christianity, others who don't convert to Christianity but are very much Armenians. And they're the tip of the iceberg. So the Armenian issue is much more complex. There are still crypto-Armenians, as you might call them, and assimilated Armenians. And, you know, there's a lot more to consider and to think about when we discuss these issues. But we need sophistication, not sitting in California or England and France and simply criticizing from there. I recommend people, well, go there, take a look, talk to the people, and then you tell me what you think it would be a feasible way of going forward.
Well, it seems to me that they're, in a sense, they must have felt that it was the right time to speak out because there are so many other problems Kurds versus Turks.
Yes.
About Kurdish rights, let alone Armenian rights. It's quite interesting that they also, in a sense, adopted this April 24th as an issue. Can you explain that in any way? How happened?
Kurdish intellectuals have talked about the Armenian issue in the past. I think they were the moral crossroads and they chose a righteous path. They did not want to do Ankara's bidding and go into denial mode, because frankly you could argue they have a material interest in denying, but they didn't. They did the exact opposite. They came out with unqualified recognition. We have to recognize the importance of that as a bedrock of future reconciliation, because if we don't, we will reach a point where the Kurdish intellectual would say, it's all very well, but we are living in the real world, we are suffering, and we cannot carry the Armenian issue on our backs when Armenians themselves are not interested in a real and practical solution. You know, and I fear that might be the case. I hope it won't be the case. We need to show that we are also willing to talk and to talk in a forthright manner, but fair manner. So if we want to talk about Armenian rights, we should also talk about Kurdish rights. I would even go so far as saying, it sounds anathema in Armenian context nowadays, but a third of Turkey's population are also refugees from the Balkans and even the Caucasus. All right, you might say, oh yes, but blah blah. But it is complicated. There are refugees too. I mean, we need to take the bigger picture into consideration, practical consideration, and address it in that way. I often say, if we got Balkan Turks living in my grandparents' property in Yozgat, I say, oh, good luck to them. You know, this is the way of the world. These are the concessions that we can make. But cultural artifacts, cultural patrimony of Turkey, safeguarding that is something different. And nobody argues with that. The churches and the cemeteries and the memory and the right of Armenians to go back as Armenians whenever they choose to do so. These are not problem areas at all. And they're also practical.
And I think, I mean, these Turkish Kurdish leaders have taken steps that have caused them to pay a steep price in terms of being persecuted, arrested, thrown in jail.
Barlo, some of the people I worked in Bitlis, frankly, when they were arrested and they went to jail, during questioning, their involvement with Armenians and specifically us was actually part of the interrogation. The Turkish state does not want them to do this, partly because if the Kurds admit to the Armenian genocide, in some ways, you're really undermining Ankara's position, which is why I say we should be in Diyarbakir to talk about these things, not in Istanbul. You know, in Istanbul, the commemoration event is they go in a little street on İstiklal Caddesi, they gather there, they play music, they have a big photograph taken, and they all go home. They don't have an impact on the city. They don't have the sort of political representation that resonates with the rest of Turkey. But in Diyarbakir, I can tell you one thing, the local television station, all the local leaders, all the mayors, all the big organizations, including trade unions, they're all there. It's a completely different ballgame. And we need to get our finger on the pulse. Can I tell you a very quick Nasrettin Hoca story?
Yes.
Nasrettin Hoca is looking for a pin. All his mayor's friends come and look for it. And they say, where did you lose a pin? And he says, over there. He points in the distance. They said, well, why aren't we looking there? And Hoca says, because there's no light there. And I feel like that's what Armenians are doing. The pin is elsewhere. The answer lies elsewhere. We can find it, but we have to be prepared to look in the right place and do the work for it. I don't think that we are doing the work for it. I'm absolutely sincere in that. This is my experience going back from 1980s, by the way. I've been going to Turkey I spent about 4 years of my life in Turkey. If I count all the months together, 4 years of my life in Turkey, and I've always probed Armenian issues in an active manner. This is my take.
And recently in our newspaper, High Sharjum at Fresno State, published an article, very interesting perspective from you regarding a Kurdish-Armenian sort of peace monument, reconciliation monument, which had been placed
in Diyarbakir,
right. And my question revolves around response in the West, and I guess we'll talk about the United States, but what responses do you get to all of your work and about, you know, all of these sort of solid pieces of evidence that there is a pathway towards some sort of reconciliation? What do you get as far as responses or feedback?
I have, at an individual level, Barlow, I had a lot of positive responses from individuals, but it's almost like a voyeuristic way. They're watching a TV program. It's not one of us getting involved. From an institutional perspective, I haven't had any response. I mean, Armenian organizations can get involved if they want. They chose not to. They don't even want to talk about it because you are making their lives harder, I believe. They don't want the burden of engagement. But it is a burden if you're serious enough. It's too much work for them. They can't be, they want to do it on a part-time basis, or you know, within their own comfort zone. Well, this is out of your comfort zone, but it's very real. The Peace Monument is a very good one. Then, and that's just, you know, I went to Batman once, right? In the middle of Batman, there's a park. It's called Aram Dikram Park. After the Armenian saying, like, it blows your mind that Armenians have a presence. When I was in Bitlis once, it was International Women's Day. I was walking through it in Tatvan, and I saw this sign in several languages, and one of them was in Armenian for International Women's Day. It's Kurds are bearing witness for us. There's a sense of guilt, and there's a sense that they want the Armenians back. This is a very palpable one. I tell Armenian people, come with me, I'll take you there. I like to see Armenian intellectuals who are willing to get involved, journalists, lawyers, what have you, to come. I think there's a lot of opposition to that. It complicates a lot of people. It ruffles their feathers because it makes life more difficult. But that is where the solution lies. Abdullah Demir, all these people are in exile, by the way, who've been supporting Armenian. The mayor of Diyarbakir is here. Abdullah Demirtas is in Switzerland, but you know what? They're still standing by their statements. So the peace monument, I think the peace monument will be demolished. In some way, the peace monument represents the current Turkish reality, including its decrepit state today, because that's the nature of the Kurdish Armenian issue. They may even demolish it, and even if they demolish it, that is also part of the narrative. As long as we focus on it, let them demolish it. And that's a reference point to us that the Turkish state does not want peace.
Do you see that now? Let's say since the attempted coup in Turkey, do you see now that the prime minister or the president Erdogan has now changed his views towards what before were maybe an opening in the Armenian genocide to now a more active denialist and also persecuting point of view?
Right. What? Erdogan is an autocrat, the way in some ways your president is an autocrat. It's a personal politics. He does things because it's personally good for him or his re-election. Erdogan tried to play the Armenian card. Erdogan made some concessions and offerings to Armenians. Armenians did not respond. I think that was wrong. Ahtam Arzu was one of them. I think we should be much more engaging. And we didn't. We simply said we're going to ignore it. It's a ploy. He changed the wording. I mean, he practically acknowledged the genocide when he says Armenians were treated in an inhuman way, guided in inhuman ways, so on and so forth. And then he mixes it with a denialist element to it. After all, he's a president of Turkey saying this. He can't go complete on the Armenian side. There's a way of engaging this by attacking him all the time, I think we lost an opportunity in coaxing him to go further and making in some ways more concessions. And this really does bother me. But Erdogan has made, I mean, the only reason that I've been able to work in Turkey is because of the changes Erdogan brought into play, that I could go and talk about it. Article 301 did not really apply, certainly did not apply to me. Having said that, you know, Hrant Dink was murdered. But then why was Hrant Dink murdered? I think because they were afraid of what's happening. Because the Turkish population is receptive to what we have to say. So this is why we need more people in Turkey speaking like human beings, addressing these issues. They lost the plot. It's a question of time.
I really want to thank you for joining me today. My guest has been Aras Sarafian. He's the director of the Gomidas Institute. How can people get a hold of you, Ara, to follow you or just find out what you're up to?
We have a website. My email address is ara@gomidas.org. I'm always looking for materials and ideas. If you have any projects to suggest, please write to me what you like to do, what you think is possible to do. Maybe we can put something together and make it real. So that will be amazing. So nothing is too small or too big. We will consider everything. We have a network. We have access. We need people with ideas and who are willing to work as well. So hopefully we'll get a few calls and something even more productive will come out of this talk. Thank you, Barlow, for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us today. Once again, our guest was Ara Sarafian, director of the Gomidas Institute based in London, England. And for all things Armenian, this is Professor Barlow Dermogradichian wishing you a good week and join us next week for another episode.